welcome to Pints with Treebeard. My name is Josh Edgren. I'm a pastor and teacher in Moscow, Idaho, and I am joined by a prince of good fellows, Jameson Winter, a man with whom I have crossed the Bosphorus Straits on multiple occasions. Jameson, tell us about yourself.
Yes, my name is Jameson Winter, and I'm the dean of the upper school at Augustine School here in Jackson, Tennessee. So, Josh, what are we talking about today?
So I think it's finally time for us to talk about the title of this podcast. So we called it Pints with Treebeard, and maybe you've been wondering why it's called that, because we up until this point haven't talked about Treebeard hardly at all. Maybe you don't wonder. Maybe it's clear as a bell. I hope so. If so, you're awesome. I think it's time for us to address this particular character in literature, because I think he's worthy of our attention, regardless of whether or not you name a podcast after him. But also kind of get into why we decided to name this thing Pints with Treebeard. So what we're going to be looking at today is the character in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings named Treebeard. Jameson, would you give us just like a biographical sketch of who Treebeard is, where we encounter him in the Lord of the Rings, and maybe his just a thumbnail sketch of his significance to the plot?
Yeah, so Merry and Pippin, two of the hobbits that set out from the Shire, are the ones who actually meet Treebeard first. Now, Gandalf has known him, but we don't know that until they meet him. That comes out in conversation. But they get separated from the rest of the Fellowship, captured by orcs. Boromir, of course, sacrifices himself. You've alluded to that in the past, to try to protect them. But they get taken, and the three hunters, Legolas, Gimli, and Aragorn, are tracking these orcs, but Merry and Pippin actually escape before they can get there to save them, and they wander into Fangorn Forest, which is actually named for Treebeard. So Treebeard also goes by the name Fangorn. It's his forest, and I guess we can go a little bit. I won't spend much time here, but we can go a little bit into the origin of the Ents. The Ents themselves are tree shepherds. So in the Silmarillion, you see that Yavanna is worried that the peoples of Middle-earth, the elves, and particularly the men and the dwarves, will cut down the trees and not care for the beautiful things that Yavanna has made. She's kind of the goddess of the woodland realms and everything that grows. And so she's the gods and goddesses in Tolkien, if you don't know, are like under deities to the one creator god. So he's not leaning so strongly into the kind of Greek or Roman or Norse mythology there.
It's very much like what Lewis does in the Space Trilogy, where he has sort of angels that govern planets. It's kind of like that in a way. They're angelic. They have authority. They have rule. They even have some sort of creative influence, but they're not on the same level by any stretch of the imagination as the one true God.
That's right. And you've got this picture in the early stages of the Silmarillion where she's upset because she recognizes, wait a minute, I think Aule, her husband, kind of lets it slip that the trees will be used for firewood and buildings and things like this. And she goes to one of the other gods and says, hey, what are you going to do for me, in essence, to kind of protect my domain and make sure that my domain is flourishing and good and that they don't just trample over it? And so the Ents are made. They are one of the four, well, known to Treebeard, one of the four goodly races of Middle-earth. And he is introduced to Merry and Pippin in this chapter. So the chapter Treebeard is there towards the beginning of The Two Towers, the beginning of Book 3. And you come to learn that he is, as I mentioned, the kind of head Ent over Fangorn Forest. And he actually is important in the story for many reasons, but in terms of plot, he's important in the story because he, after his kind of getting to know Merry and Pippin, rouses the Ents to war, and they go and conquer Isengard and overthrow Saruman, who has been laying waste to the forest and abusing the kind of power and authority that he was given, and using it in service of Sauron and really in service of himself. We could talk more about that another time, and they're kind of the conflict of evil with evil. But that's Treebeard's kind of significance. To this point, the Ents haven't been involved in the war, and he is kind of the one who, actually for the first episode not of our podcast, you see his war song, calling the Ents to battle to go to Isengard, and that's Tolkien reading that. So that's a little glimpse into his significance in the story.
Yeah, so physically the Ents in Tolkien's world, they're, you know, 14 feet tall, they're tree-like, but they have arms and legs like men. And their work is to guard the trees, to shepherd the trees, both to protect the trees from the those who would abuse them, but also to protect, you know, the outsiders from the trees in a sense, right? That's also part of his work. So he presides over Fangorn Forest, which, you know, is a shadow of its former self by the time we get to this part in The Lord of the Rings. I used to be much broader. What's the state of the trees at this point? One of the dangers that Treebeard is guarding against is not just the encroachment of Saruman and the orcs and the Uruk-hai and the evil men, but also the trees themselves going bad, the trees going to sleep, the Ents becoming tree-ish. So you have this movement to nothingness, to returning to a lack of personality, that is a gift that the Ents were given to be rational, but they're not using it, and so they're going back to sleep. So Treebeard is aware of that, and you see him with deep love for his flock, and desiring them to be safe, but them to be well, and that's when Merry and Pippin find him.
One interesting statement that he makes to Merry and Pippin is, I guess, a couple of things. First, he talks about not giving your true name too quickly, and he says that and then contextualizes it by saying there are Ents and Ents, you know, and then there are things that are Ents and things that ain't, as they might say, which is so fascinating. But he kind of expounds on that a few pages later when he talks about what you just said, that many of the trees are just asleep and some are half awake, and there are a few who are quite wide awake and getting entish. And he says that's going on all the time. Then he says this: when that happens to a tree, you find that some have bad hearts. Nothing to do with their wood, I do not mean that, but he's saying that these trees are becoming entish and taking on ent-like qualities, and yet they're using that for wickedness. They're using that for ill.
Right. They're being violent. They're being aggressive towards men in a way the trees ought not to be.
Quick question there. What do you think is going on with Old Man Willow back in the outskirts of the Shire? I'm just curious to hear your thoughts. We haven't talked about this before.
Well, Treebeard talks about that directly. He references willows. He says, why, I knew some good old willows down the Entwash, gone long ago, alas. They were quite hollow. Indeed, they were all falling to pieces, right? So that's an interesting reference to willows that are hollow, that just dissipate. But of course, we've already met a willow, and that's been extremely important in the course of the story for Frodo particularly, but also for Merry and Pippin, who were the ones kind of sucked into the willow. So it's no coincidence that Tolkien is using this adventure with Old Man Willow and then gives them the real thing in Treebeard. But we have an example of trees that have become awake but are full of malice. So I think that Old Man Willow is an example of what Treebeard is just talking about there, and is what it's doing on a deeper level, I don't know. But can you imagine ways in which in the modern world now, like, forests or the wilderness or parts of nature have become inhospitable, like more so? I don't know. Can you imagine that?
I think that's maybe somewhat what Tolkien is getting at here. I think it's a corruption because they lack the shepherds, right? Because they're losing the rulers who are supposed to be guiding and directing them. And
yeah, that's
there's
good.
There's too many sheep to shepherd in that sense, and so many of them are going astray. If you can track with that. It's funny that I ask, because if I literally kept reading the next sentence, that's the sentence that you read, why I knew some good old willows down the Entwash, because I'd always thought, okay, this is what's happening, right? The trees that are waking up, that's Old Man Willow. That was my thought. But I had never noticed that he actually uses Willows as his example, and that they're hollow. And
yeah, right.
Literally, Old Man Willow is a hollow willow. He swallows up two of the hobbits, and
right.
they have to be retrieved out of him. And so, yeah, it seems clear. If I just kept reading that one sentence in this context, I would have probably put two and two together. But I think really quickly, before we move on, that idea of falling to pieces, he says they were quite hollow. Indeed, they were falling all to pieces. And I think that idea is not just literally, but they're being hollowed out, like they don't have their purpose. And
yeah.
Like you said, kind of the natural world becoming inhospitable because it's not being cultivated into a garden as it should be. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
if the caretakers were doing their job, or if there were enough caretakers, or, you know, whatever, then it would be garden-like. It would be kind of the trees would be serving their function properly.
A major theme of the Ents, of course, is being slow, right? The Treebeard's motto, as he says explicitly to Merry and Pippin, is don't be hasty. We've taken that as kind of the tagline of this podcast, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But the speed at which things happen is something that Treebeard refers to again and again. And he talks about how, you know, I couldn't tell you my name because it would take too long to say. You know, when he struggles for a word, sometimes he'll slip into Entish, and, you know, it rumbles on and on and on and on and on. And then Merry and Pippin say, oh, you mean this? And he's like, oh, yeah. What is that great bit about hills?
Oh, yes.
Says, oh, yes. That's a hasty word for something that has been around as long as the world was made, or, you know, something along those lines. But you have this this really interesting, the time scale of the Ent is off from men and dwarves and hobbits. But interestingly, and Treebeard says this, interestingly, it's faster than elves, right? So he says later on, just down the page from that bit you read, he says, and yet again, Ents are more like men, more changeable than elves are, and quicker at taking the color of the outside, you might say. Or better than both, for they are steadier and keep their minds on things longer. So here you have this, they are changeable. They're not like elves that stay the same forever and ever, but they are slow to change, steady, stable, able to attend to things in a way that is fitting for a tree, right? A tree does change. It grows, right? I've got outside of my window, outside of my dining room window, I planted a row of fruit trees, and they grow fast, and it's wonderful, but they don't grow that fast. You know, like it is changeable, but it's changeable in a very slow time scale. And that's present throughout all of Treebeard's dealings with the hobbits.
Yeah. I had never considered deeply the contrast between Ents and elves, and Ents, like he says, being more like the men, taking on the color of the outside, as you said. But it really does make sense when you hold up in contrast the elves that we think about, maybe because of a certain series of films, as very refined and regal and majestic. And then the elves that are also present in Lord of the Rings that you wouldn't see in films like that, that are just silly and playful and,
you know,
going from thing to thing, singing all of the nonsensical songs when Bilbo
Flighty.
And the dwarves
yeah,
and Gandalf
in
come in. In The Hobbit. But you actually have, you could think, oh, he's just changing the elves from book to book. But you have references to many elves like that in Rivendell. It's just a kind of passing reference, but I read it recently mm-hmm. with the boys, and he does reference many of the elves just going in for, I think it's some of them don't come to the feast because they're too busy, like kind of frolicking and singing playful
I remember
songs
that.
And things like that. So it's just interesting that, as he says, the Ents keep their mind on one thing for a long time, because you see the word flighty is good. You see this kind of flitting to and fro, back and forth between things with many of the elves, not all of the elves.
We'll touch on this more later. But the image of a tree is appropriate and potent for us as we consider the nature of masculinity, particularly. You know, trees are mighty. They're strong. They're weighty. You know, you have Treebeard says, you know, Sauron tried to make Ents, but he failed and made trolls. Like, trolls are the weak counterfeit of Ents. You want to see real strength, right? And, you know, the idea of roots crushing boulders over time, right? That's, you know, potency, but also the rootedness, the boundness, the slowness, the gravitas, that comes from being bound to a place, bound to your people. So that is a wonderful, wonderful image of masculinity. But then also you have this idea of being fruitful, of bearing fruit. But the fruit only comes if you've got a good strong trunk. You've got good strong roots that bind you to the earth.
Yeah, and there's so much, as we've talked about, so much biblical imagery that draws on this idea of being like a tree. Psalm 1, the righteous man is like a tree. Its roots go down near the water and draw up life from the water. And that should, I think, draw our minds back to the garden and this river watering the garden of God. And I think in many ways representing God's life and presence that he gives in the garden and then goes out into four other rivers that spread over the whole earth, which there's a lot there that we could go down into as well. But minimally, the trees, the plants of the garden are sucking up this nutrients, this goodness from God, and they're bearing fruit. And what do we read about all the time in the Gospels? What image does Jesus continue to come back to? The image of bearing fruit for the kingdom. And even now, the axe is laid to the root of the tree, right? Because of these wicked trees that aren't bearing fruit. If you bear good fruit, you'll be blessed. If any tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire, right? From the Sermon on the Mount. So there's all of this imagery, and it kind of changes and twists and is modified. You have the olive tree being cursed, representing Jerusalem and the fact that they're about to reject the Messiah, and that they're going to shrivel up and die in that sense. Mm-hmm. You have the olive branches of the farewell discourse in John's gospel and remaining in the branch of Christ, right? You have the stump of Jesse, a shoot will come forth from the stump of Jesse. You have all of these biblical images of olives and grapes and trees and plants that bring forth life. And there's something there. There's a deep and rich symbolism going on there in the scriptures that I've only begun to plumb the depths of, personally, but it's really profound to see, I think, Tolkien picking up on it, maybe in an informal way, and working that into the story so naturally by creating the Ents.
It's great. Yeah. I mean, even you look at the very, very, very beginning, you know, what's the first command? What's the first word spoken to Adam and Eve recorded in Genesis? We know that God spoke to Adam before this, but in Genesis 1, the first word is, you know, be fruitful. Literally, you know, fruit is the first word, right? And so this is metaphorical. They had to understand, like, oh, huh. So like that thing over there that has this stuff on the end of it, I'm supposed to be like that, right? So even at the very, very, very beginning, you have God saying, you're like a tree, like be fruitful. But then you've got, yeah, Psalm 1 is exactly right. You even have, you know, incidentally, Nebuchadnezzar's a tree, right? He's a tree that's then cut down. You have then in the New Testament, you have the fruit of the Spirit. Like, what does the Spirit do? How does Paul describe what the Spirit does? Well, he says it's like, you know, it's like if you're a tree. And what does air and water and light do for you? Well, it makes you fruitful. It makes you produce according to your kind. Jesus says, you know, the good tree makes good fruit. The bad tree makes bad fruit. You know them by their fruits. And then you have the orchard of the New Jerusalem as well, which produces its fruit. You know, 12 trees, you know, typically in the scriptures, 12 is symbolic of the people of God. You know, the people of God are fruitful. And what's interesting, I've never thought about this until just now, the Psalm 1, the man produces fruit in its season. In New Jerusalem, it produces fruit every month, right?
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
In all seasons. He's always fruitful, which is just, that's neat.
Yeah, I had never considered that either. And again, it just goes to show how much there is to kind of mine out of the scriptures, the riches there tied to the imagery of being tree-like. So let's go into it. Let's talk a bit about what the purpose was in naming the podcast after Treebeard and this idea maybe even of having a pint with Treebeard. What does it mean to sit down and have a pint with a fictional character who can't actually talk back to you? Because one of the central ideas that you and I talked about when we were starting the podcast was this idea of slowing down and imagining, what if we could do this in person, right? What if the two of us could sit down, talk through fatherhood together, talk about being a dad, and shoot ideas back and forth, and just take time to contemplate and then put into practice the things that we discuss. But you have to take the time to actually consider and think and ponder and reflect and assess and maybe get some constructive feedback along the way. And so to be able to do that together is a great blessing. To be able to share that with anyone else is also just wonderful and a great joy. So obviously we don't literally sit down with Treebeard the character, but we do sit down, and I think we're both trying to contemplate ideas in the way that he would, and not rush through life assuming that things are going the way that they're supposed to and that you don't need to redirect anything. Like the old proverb, to bend a tree when it's young, right? I don't want to run through fatherhood assuming that the tree is growing up in the right way. I want to bend it when it's young, if I see that it's not getting enough sunlight, so that it grows up in the proper direction. And it's easier to course correct on those things if you're regularly slowing down to assess them, which is hopefully what we can be doing here with one another, but also, you know, as a resource for others.
Yeah. The perennial temptation that I've noticed in myself, but also that I've sensed in other, you know, guys in our age and station, young dads, beginning stages of a career, finally kind of getting things established, but maybe you're wishing you were further along than you are, or maybe you see other guys who are, further along than you are, and this impatience, right? Or me, I notice it every day. It feels like when I get home and I think about all the house projects I'm not working on.
Yeah.
And I just think, golly, I just don't have, there's elements of that is just sloth in me, and I should mortify that. But what I've come to notice is, no, the problem is I'm reluctant to submit to the demands of my station. I want to rush off and do something else instead of being rooted and submitting to the little patch that I'm in. And what I need to do is I need to submit to the work that I'm given, and to not be impatient, to not be rushing off after some imagined success and thus shirking my duties where I am. And so my sense is that I'm not the only one in that position who needs to be reminded, no, you're supposed to be fruitful. What does that mean? It means that you submit to the soil you're in, the sunshine that you're in, the air that you're in, and you produce fruit. And what's the main fruit that I'm producing? Well, it's six little people. And that's the thing that I've been called to steward. And you can't make a tree produce fruit faster, right? You just have to let it ripen. And okay, so God made me to be a tree. I've got to submit to what it means to be a tree and not try to rush off and be a rhinoceros or something.
And that means that you also have to keep in mind that there are gathering seasons and there are growing seasons. And you could say, like trees, we produce fruit in kind of a cyclical fashion, that there are great leaps and bounds where you take the apple off the tree and put it into a pie. And then there's the winter time where the tree kind of loses its leaves and shrivels up a little bit. And it's not dead, but it's in a different season. And those seasons aren't very fun when you're just slammed and you don't see the progress. You don't see what's coming. You've disciplined your son, you know, five or six times today, and you don't see the fruit yet, but the fruit will come. There will be a springtime and there will be a summer and then a fall when you reap the harvest, and that will be bountiful. That will be delightful. And so we have to not only be patient in the sense of having like a long-term goal, but to recognize there are different seasons where the fruit is more clear, and I need to be okay with that. Because if I went out and checked an apple tree in my yard in the middle of winter and I said, well, there's no apples, I better cut it down and change everything and plant something else here. Well, then I've ruined a perfectly good apple tree, right? And that's just counterproductive in every way. And one of the images when we come to this part in the book in class that I try to give the sixth graders is, the idea that you already mentioned of a root kind of busting up stones and busting up concrete, because I see that every day when I drive home. There's this huge oak tree in our front yard, and it takes three.
It
would take three of me to wrap my arms around it. And I see these 8 to 12 inch huge bumps in the asphalt where the roots have just grown up through it. And I actually had to remove asphalt recently because I'm driving over it, and it's like driving over a curb because this root has, has broken up the concrete, and the bricks that surrounded it that were kind of very nicely put there years and years ago have all fallen apart, and it's broken up the walls. And I use that kind of image with my students to ask them to think about fruitfulness in their lives and what it looks like. I mean, one day, you know, in school, to graduate, to walk across the stage, like, how do you get to that point? You do what's put in front of you today faithfully, and you do it again the next day and again the next day. And there's a metaphor in there, not just for graduating, but for life, which is you're always doing the things that turn you into the kind of person you're becoming. I'll say that one more time. You're always doing the things that turn you into the person that you're becoming. I want them to understand that they can't snap their fingers one day and become a godly man or woman. They have to do the kinds of things that bring godliness, that cultivate godly habits every day for a long period of time, just like roots have to drink up the water in the soil every day and leaves have to drink in the sunshine every day. And that grows the tree into, you know, 100-foot oak tree with thousands and thousands of leaves that I'm going to have to rake all winter.
Ah, yes, indeed, indeed. Yeah, and the tree is... such an incredibly complex, you know, organism that does this very simple, quiet thing. That's lovely as well. So just piling on to all of that, we felt like, I don't know, we need someone to tell us on a weekly-ish basis, slow down, hang tight, be patient, be content, do what's set in front of you. Boy, who better to tell you that than Treebeard? But there's also the pints aspect, right? We want this to be convivial. We want this to be fun, enjoying the good things of God. So, you know, when possible, we have actual pints with us. And, you know, today it was a pint of coffee. But, hey, that's all right. But then also it calls to mind that wonderful scene in the Two Towers when Treebeard brings Merry and Pippin back to one of his homes, he says, and he feeds them beads. He serves them the ant draft. And they drink it, and they become taller. He literally grows them up and matures them. And that's fun because you get to see it happening, you know, immediately. And Sam and Frodo talk about it when they're reunited at the end, which is great. But that's what we're doing as dads. We're trying to grow up our little people. And it'd be kind of fun if we got to see it happen in front of our eyes. And by the way, it almost does. Like, wow, you are taller than you were yesterday. But also, we're trying to grow up. And there's this sense in which we want to get taller, like we want to mature and become godlier men for the sake of the little people we've been given. There's this another great line in the Two Towers when they come back to Fangorn's house, you know, to Treebeard's house, and he says, "Now, tell me your story, and please don't hurry it." And I just think that's wonderful and encapsulates a lot that we also are trying to imbibe. You know, let's take as long as it takes to deal with these things. Let's try to curb as much as we're able the modern desire to rush through everything. One more element that I want to bring out in terms of submitting to your own work and doing your own work. I think Treebeard is also an example, not just of the slowing down, but also of the decisive action. So if he were just, if this were just a character who said, you know, come in and sit by the fire and let's have a cozy chat and let's never do anything, that would be an incomplete picture of masculinity. But that's not the picture we're given in Treebeard at all. And this is a great line. Treebeard says, "I used to be anxious when the shadow lay on Mirkwood, but when it removed to Mordor, I did not trouble with it. I didn't have trouble for a while. Mordor's a long way away. But it seems that the wind is setting east and the withering of all woods may be drawing near. There is naught that an old Ent can do to hold back that storm. He must weather it or crack." So he's talking about this big growing trouble. He says, an old Ent, what can he do? But then he goes on. He says, but Saruman now. Saruman is a neighbor. I cannot overlook him. I must do something, I suppose. I've often wondered lately what I should do about Saruman. And I think that's also just wonderful for a man to think about. I can't go and defeat Mordor. I can't stop this rising tide. You know what? It may be that the withering of all woods is at hand. It may be that we all go out in a blaze of glory. But you know what? Saruman's a neighbor. That's on my turf. He's in my plot. And I've got to deal with the evil in my backyard. So this idea of taking responsibility for what's mine. I can't fix all the evils in the world, right? And me, you know, going online and like so many young men nowadays do, and go online and complain. Like, that's purposeless. Doesn't do anything. But I can take responsibility for the evil that is in my backyard. I can take responsibility for me, my family, and my neighbor. And that's what I ought to do. And so then we see with Treebeard, decisive, dramatic, terrifying action. So it's slow, slow, slow. He's not hot-headed. He's not hasty. But when it's time to act, there's no holding back. And that's the right image.
And he brings others along in it as well. I mean, if you want to extend the metaphor for us, this is like the old man who knows what life is like and can give counsel to those of us in this stage of life and give us kind of a heading to pursue this quest, whatever it is, whatever battles we have to fight, can give us direction. And as we seek to apply our strength to these problems as young men, we need elders who will shepherd us, both literally elders in the church, right? There's a reason that they're called elders, but also just elder men, older men who have wisdom and can bestow them on us. And so that's, again, this idea of let's sit with Treebeard. And in some sense, I think we would both agree here, by extent, sit down with Tolkien, someone who lived in a different time, who, and not all too different, right? But who did live in a different time and who had a different kind of perspective on the world and saw some of the changes that we're now reaping the fruits of as they were happening, mm-hmm. and was very disgusted by some of them. And now we see kind of the fruit of the ways that society has changed and the ways that he was lamenting and the losing of, I think, not just a sense of Christianity in the culture or something like that, but living with purpose as human beings, that, you know, he would have seen the change in society at large, not merely in those who would call themselves Christians, but in the ways that everyone lived in the first half of the 20th century and how dramatically different that was by the end of his life. I think it's so helpful to sit down with the work of a man in different shoes and wrestle with the great minds of the past in that way. And this is just such a good way to do it. It's such a fun way to do it too. But you reminded me of the end of the chapter when Merry and Pippin are talking to Treebeard and they say, but Saruman will try to stop you, won't he? And then he says, yes, I have not forgotten that. Indeed, I have long thought about it. But you see, many of the Ents are younger than I am by many lives of trees, and they are all roused now. And their mind is all on one thing, breaking Isengard. He said they'll start to think before long and they'll have their evening drink and essentially they'll cool off, right? But right now they're roused to action and it's my task to direct them and guide them in that work, which is, again, just this idea that we fight these battles with a neighbor, like you said, with Saruman on our front door, because we can't, look, none of us are going to have an influence directly on the geopolitical state of our nation, much less the global kind of world that we live in. But we can have an effect on our community, and maybe not even your whole city, but the families that you know and the neighborhood that you live in. You do have a deep-rooted effect there, maybe pun intended, on the people around you. And that's the kind of life that we want to cultivate for ourselves. And that's the kind of life we want our children to see as valuable, where you can make a difference here because you have 70, 80, 90 years, perhaps. And so invest yourself in making a difference in the place that you're in. And it's not going to look glorious. And so often the Christian life doesn't look glorious in that way. but your faithfulness will bring great change over time. And Christians working together and young men working together towards that end bring great change. One ant alone can't stand against Isengard even, and that's their neighbor, right? That's where they want to make change.
Yeah, but one can't do it.
You need a group of ants roused together working in the same direction.
Mm-hmm. I just want to finish the rest of that paragraph you started because I think it speaks to that exactly. Because they'll start thinking again before long. They'll cool down a little when we take our evening drink. What a thirst we shall have. But let them march now and sing. We have a long way to go, and there is time ahead for thought. And this line is wonderful. It is something to have started. Like, we've started. We've gotten going. And that's not nothing. It's something to have begun. Having prepared, having weighed, having measured, having considered for so long, now we are acting. And that is not to be despised, right? Don't despise the day of small beginnings, which is also, I think, something that dads need to hear. Like, you're in the small beginnings of your family, right? Your family is a small thing right now. Do not despise the day of small beginnings. It is something to have started. And who knows where it'll go.
Well, on the note of family, do you want to wrap up with Ant Wives?
Let's do it.
All right. So I think you're gonna read the poem here, but just as a way of introduction, you have already maybe mentioned this a little bit, but at least alluded to it. There's this really interesting dynamic of the Ents and the Ent Wives who are now missing, the masculine and the feminine. And so I'm going to let you read it, and then maybe we can get into some kind of stream of conscious thoughts about what Tolkien might be doing here.
Let's do it. I love it. So this is a poem. He says, "It was never an Entish song, mark you. It would have been a very long song in Entish, but we know it by heart and hum it now and again. This is how it runs in your tongue." Stanza one, the Ent. "When spring unfolds the beechen leaf and sap is in the bough, when light is on the wildwood stream and wind is on the brow, when stride is long and breath is deep and keen the mountain air, come back to me. Come back to me, and say my land is fair." And wife. "When spring is come to garth and field, and corn is in the blade, when blossom like a shining snow is on the orchard laid, when shower and sun upon the earth with fragrance fill the air, I'll linger here, and will not come, because my land is fair." And "when summer lies upon the world, and in a noon of gold, beneath the roof of sleeping leaves the dreams of trees unfold, when woodland halls are green and cool and wind is in the west, come back to me, and say my land is best." And wife. "When summer warms the hanging fruit and burns the berry brown, when straw is gold and ear is white and harvest comes to town, when honey spills and apple swells, though wind be in the west, I'll linger here beneath the sun, because my land is best." And "when winter comes, the winter wild that hill and wood shall slay, when trees shall fall and starless night devour the sunless day, when wind is in the deadly east, then in the bitter rain, I'll look for thee and call to thee, I'll come to thee again." And wife. "When winter comes and singing ends, when darkness falls at last, when broken is the barren bough and light and labor past, I'll look for thee and wait for thee until we meet again. Together we will take the road beneath the bitter rain, both. Together we will take the road that leads into the west, and far away we'll find a land where both our hearts may rest." So, I have my thoughts on this. You have your thoughts on this. Let's just go and see what happens in our last couple of minutes here. It seems to me that Tolkien is presenting the masculine and the feminine, and he's lamenting the fact that the masculine and the feminine are divided, right? So, you have the masculine urge to go out of the wilds, right? To conquer, to journey, to voyage, to go out where it's lonely and dangerous. And you see that in these descriptions here, you know, when stride is long and breath is deep and keen the mountain air, right? That idea of journeying, going out, conquering, being alone in the lonely work of taking dominion. So that's the masculine urge. And then the feminine urge is the domestic, right? It's to cultivate, to grow, to garden, to beautify. And you see that keenly in the Ent Wives portions, right? When blossom like a shining snow is on the orchard laid, when shower and sun upon the earth with fragrance fill the air, right? This idea of beauty and fruit and growth, but growth on a small, homey scale. And when you have those divided, when the masculine conquering and lonely work is not wedded to the domestic fruitfulness, then you just have a barren world. And so I'm not sure what Tolkien sees as the problem, right? Why have the Ents lost the Entwives? Who's at fault? And the poem is interesting because you have the Ent going out and calling her to him, and she won't come. And then at the end, he says, I'll come back to you. I'll come to you again, right? So is it that the Ent went out and didn't love his family? Or is it that the Entwife wouldn't come? So there you go. Thoughts?
I think in the context, we see both of those things as true to some degree, because he says, just in the paragraphs leading up to this, he's giving them the story that goes with the song. And
yeah,
let's see. He talks about how they were interested in different things, right? The Ents fixed their mind on the greatest trees and the mountains and the things of the elves, and the Entwives focused on different things, on the smaller, lesser trees and the fruit-bearing plants and trees and things like this. But then he also says that they made gardens. The Entwives make these gardens, and they desire things to be ordered. And he adds this little comment, by which they mean that things should remain where they had set them, which I find delightful. And like Tolkien's just little nod to marriage being a challenge at times because of the masculine-feminine dynamic we have with our wives, that there's this desire to have order and this desire to live in the place that is ordered. And those two things can't be exactly realized at the same time. They have to be harmonized in a way that's fitting to both of them. But then he does say that they wander and they come to see them less. And then the Entwives move their gardens. They make new gardens on the other side of the river, which is the Brownland. So this would be like south of Mirkwood, I believe. And then they're gone. The Ents don't come to see them often anymore. In fact, it says that they learn of the men, and many of the men, the Entwives learn of the men there who live in the Brownlands, and many of the men learn the craft of the Entwives. And so they're teaching them interacting, but the Ents are only legends to the men. That's how seldom they're coming and seeing the Entwives. So, yeah, I don't know what, like you said, I don't know what Tolkien's getting at there in terms of what the actual cause is that's bringing about the fracturing. And I'm not sure how much this is a lament and just the way that things are for the Ents because of the world, and how much the world is suffering because of the way that the Ents are acting. You know, it's kind of a chicken or the egg sort of thing that I'm not sure what Tolkien's getting at there.
It's easy to imagine Tolkien looking at the world around him and seeing, you know, after the Industrial Revolution, the work of the household became fractured. Right? Men go off to the factories, women stay home, and it's no longer this productive household sort of thing that, you know, T.R. Wiley talks about, and lots of other guys talk about. But it's easy to imagine the men going off and having their careers be further and further separated from their families, and having the families being further and further separated from their fathers. And so it's almost a fatherlessness thing going on. And so as the father and the household drift apart until finally they forget about each other. And so it's easy to imagine Tolkien watching this in real time, or having seen it take place in the early days of the 20th century, and seeing, like, if this continues, the men will be separated from their households, and this will be the end of productive society. Like, this will be the end of... But it's interesting, he doesn't talk about fatherlessness. Right, he just says there's no more Entings. He doesn't say the Entings are abandoned. So I don't know. That's my take. That he's lamenting the separation of the man and his household that is necessitated by this modern industrial world. I'm not going to go to the stake for it, but
I think you're right, and I think as you talk, it makes me consider that he's also dealing with life after World War One, and is seeing, so it's a very striking picture when they come across the Anduin to look for the Entwives, and Treebeard's noting that the the Entwives have grown old and brown and bent by their labor, and their leaves are parched by the sun. And so there's this kind of this division that's come between them and the Ents due to just the fact that they're aging in different places. They're growing old. Like you mentioned, I'm growing old at my job during the day and gaining gray hairs and coming home, and those gray hairs are there in my beard. And Megan is coming back into contact with me and seeing me older than I was before. Right. And there's this fracturing, like you said, of the work of a household, not being tied to the household, but being tied to this weird kind of ethereal economy with numbers in a computer. I mean, we've gone so far that it's all just numbers in a computer. There's not even like cash in a bank somewhere.
Right.
It's just a line of code is the money that you're putting there. Right. So it's all of this kind of abstraction of a household's work and value. I don't mean value in an eternal sense. I mean just value to the community, right? What is the value that you bring to this city or your town? It's measured in these weird and abstract ways. So there's that part of it. Like, we're just growing up in different worlds, and we get to come back together, thankfully, regularly, daily, most of the time, right? It's not like we're going years without seeing each other. But there's also this aspect of World War One kind of in the back of his mind, or maybe in the front of his mind. I don't know, even as he's writing in the 50s. And then World War II, of course, as well. And the fact that Europe has just been ravaged by war, which is what he says happens to the Brownlands. He says they went to find the Entwives and it was a desert. In other words, the opposite of a garden.
Yeah.
Because war had devoured it. War had come through and the Entwives were gone. And they ask about them, they can't find them. But I imagine there's some of that there as well, like a kind of loss of the family unit and the closeness that you have and the security that you have in a family, but also the desert that that creates in a society when families are broken apart. And you have a generation of that, two generations of that, really, in the world wars. Like, literally, families are broken apart, not even necessarily because of choices that they made, but because these men went off and died in war. And I think there's probably some of that in his mind as well. I mean, he's not writing this to be an allegory for that. He's very clear about that. But he's writing about the world that he knows. He's drawing on things that he's experienced. And that would have been very real in his mind, to watch family after family after family of his friends who die in the war, and just see the brokenness over the years and lament that.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that there's a lot that we could learn from this picture of the masculine and the feminine being, you know, being different and needing to be united for there to be harmonious, you know, society. And so I think that we could talk about productive households more in a future time, and maybe we can harken back to this passage when we do so. But unfortunately, we have other oceans to swim, other mountains to climb today. So let's hit some book recommendations, sir. What do you have for us today?
So last time you recorded, you told me that you had not read Julius Caesar. And so that's my recommendation this week, is Julius Caesar by Shakespeare, the play. So you recommended basically all of Shakespeare, which is good and right. But Julius Caesar, I was just thinking more about why it's a crime that you haven't read that book before. And why people should read it. And I mentioned that it's got some of the greatest quotes in literature, but what do I really mean by that? I'll just tease out a couple of things. I think Shakespeare does a great job of helping you to see in a kind of narratively, what do I want to say, believable way, the confusing nature of Julius Caesar as a historical figure, and not knowing who you should side with when you look at it and see on the face of it that, you know, there's this great ambitious man who conquers most of the known world and who does so much for the Roman Empire, and yet is threatening, or just is a tyrant, threatening to become a tyrant, or just is a tyrant. And so then you have these conspirators on the other side. But he plays so well with the dynamics of civil war and the idea of ambition and injustice and treachery, obviously, like the whole political assassination aspect is just a compelling drama. And you've got the conspirators, and you've got this dream given to Calpurnia to prevent Caesar from going out when he's going to be killed. And so many different themes that are touched on in many different ways through other stories kind of coalesce in one work. And it's brief, it's short, so it's just like a fast-paced, thrilling kind of political drama around these characters that are larger than life. But the whole time you're thinking about it, you're remembering, this actually happened. Like, this isn't the historical account, but he is drawing a lot from history. And like, even Calpurnia's dream, he didn't just make that up. He's drawing it from a source that, okay, maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. But you know, he's bringing to bear some of the most fundamentally human questions in Julius Caesar. And it's just a gripping narrative the whole way through.
I'll read it. I've got a very, very different work for us today, and that is Leif by Niggle by J.R.R. Tolkien. I couldn't go too much longer without recommending that one. It's a delightful story about a painter who can never seem to finish his painting, and it's wonderfully autobiographical, and it deals with how you should love your neighbor. It's great. Leif by Niggle, J.R.R. Tolkien.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for the day, so thank you for joining us. We hope you've enjoyed the show, and if you'd like to follow what we're writing about, you can find a link to our Substack in the notes below. You can also find a link to Shane Caver's music. We want to say thank you to Shane for the use of our theme music during the show. And with that, we hope you've been blessed and edified by the show.
Don't be hasty.
And then, you know, you can allow that to lead you wherever you want. Hither and yon.
Okay.
To and fro. There and back again.
Perfect.